Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
Hi.
We're a day late and a dollar short. Hopefully not a dollar short, but a day late.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that was so rude of us.
I'm so sorry. That was my fault. But you know, stuff happens and I could have been ready. It just wasn't there.
Okay.
The victims deserved better.
Okay.
So I really wanted to put a little bit more time into the story and deliver it better.
Okay. So, well, thank you for that.
Yeah. We have so much to get to in this episode. It could have easily been another two parts. There's a lot of victims in this one, a lot of names, a lot of places. But hopefully we can all get through it together and you can follow. Let's just
pick up where we left off.
Let's just go.
Kind of.
Before we get started in part two, I have a bit of a correction for part one. In part one, I said that they never found the broomstick that was used to kill Louise Sullivan.
Okay.
They didn't find it the night that Roy took them on that, you know, hunt for the evidence, but they did eventually recover it.
Okay.
So I just wanted to clear that up. I misspoke. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We'll forgive you.
Sometimes you get it wrong.
Yeah.
And I did. So
I get it wrong a lot. Yeah, so I'll let you I'll let you have that one.
If you haven't listened to part one of The Monster that is Kenneth Alan McDuff, you should go listen to that now. So many outlets I came across in my research just glossed over his first three murders.
Mm-hmm.
And those victims matter.
Absolutely.
Just as much as the others, in my opinion. At the end of part one, we talked about how Kenneth was sentenced to death for the murders of Robert Brand, Marcus Dunham, and Edna Louise Sullivan, and how that sentence was commuted to life with the possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth didn't act alone, though. As we know, his buddy Roy Del Green accompanied him and assisted in the murders. Though we believe Kenneth was the driving force and did most of the work. I think we could all agree about that.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Del Green got 25 years for pleading guilty with malice in the murder of Louise Sullivan because his attorney told him that if you don't take this, like, you could get the death penalty.
Oh,
so
wow.
He wanted to plead without malice, but he was like, you should really take the step up because you might be gambling.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Roy didn't really do well in prison. I mean, he was relentlessly bullied, but you know, it's prison.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not supposed to be fun.
Did you expect Chick-fil-A customer service?
Yes, they do.
I mean, it doesn't matter that you're not this hardened criminal type. You do the crime, you do the time, children. Okay? Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if it's your first crime. Doesn't matter.
Consequences.
That's part of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
He trucked along for several years in there, and then 1976 rolled around, and he was sent to Rusk State Hospital when he started having visions and hearing voices, so much so that he could not sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
He was there for 3 years, and he was paroled in 1979, serving a total of 13 years for his participation in the murders.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So you already know that Kenneth was also paroled and free to kill again.
Yes.
Despite the seriousness of Kenneth's previous crimes and the extraordinarily high risk of recidivism, he was paroled in 1989. He was previously denied parole. I mentioned this in part one. Mm-hmm. After he tried bribing the board, and he got slapped with a bribery charge, but that got dropped. Had that charge stuck, it could have easily landed his booty in prison for the rest of his life.
Right.
But this is Kenneth McDuff we're talking about, and he has this like slimy film coating all over his body, and nothing seems to stick to it.
Yeah.
Except for dirt and debris. I also talked a little bit about the Texas criminal justice system in part one and how the system was just garbage and how the crimes that Kenneth committed would influence some major changes. And I'll get to that later on in the episode. So at the time Kenneth McDuff was paroled, according to the Texas Monthly Report, 8 out of every 10 inmates that were taken before the parole board were paroled.
With 8 out of 10?
Yes. With little to no review of their file at all. Due to overcrowding in the prisons, there were categories that inmates were lumped into. Take a breath, everybody, because this is going to infuriate you. So inmates were lumped into categories, and that would more or less determine their eligibility. Now, Kenneth wasn't a model inmate by any stretch. He wasn't a model person
before
he was sent to prison. And when he went to prison, it's not like he was in there doing haircuts and like getting a degree or, you know what I mean? He was not doing anything of use in there. He was smuggling drugs at times. I read that his brother brought him drugs and he was selling it in there, using it in there. Overall, just being a tough guy around the place. So back then, what in the world were they looking at to consider him in the category for release?
Right.
Well, I'm going to tell you in detail.
Okay.
How that happened. And I will be going there and I will be naming names.
Okay. Okay. Let's hear it.
So Robert Riggs with WFAA TV reported that on Kenneth's 15th request for parole. 15th.
Wow. He was diligent, huh?
I guess. There were only 3 people on the board voting with regard to his release. Cora Mosley, Dr. James Granberry, and Chris Mealy. Cora Mosley later admitted that she didn't even open the file before casting her vote.
Oh, good. I'm glad you care.
Cora Mosley is her name. But Dr. James Granberry did look at it, at least long enough to notice the name of Kenneth's attorney, Gary Jackson, who was Dr. Granberry's childhood friend.
Oh.
And he said, you know what? This is a conflict of interest. I'm going to step back. Someone else should vote in my place.
Okay.
He did the right thing. So they got someone to replace him, a man named Henry Keene. Now, Cora and Chris voted to approve his release. Probably having thoroughly reviewed Kenneth's file, Henry said, H-E double hockey sticks to the N-O.
Don't do it.
2 for yes, 1 for no means they were going to grant his parole.
Wow.
But Tarrant County DA, Tim Curry, said, hold on. Do y'all know what y'all are, like, do you know who you're voting on? Like, you need to take another look at this guy's case file.
Wow.
And vote again.
Mm-hmm.
So, a new, I'm using air quotes here, guys, a new 3-person panel was assembled consisting of Chris Mealy,
not new,
and kept his vote of yes. Henry Keene, also not new, and kept his vote of H-E double hockey sticks N-O, and Dr. James Granberry.
Oh, he's back on.
He's back on. Why would he recuse himself in the first vote only to then come back and vote?
Because they needed someone new.
How was that even allowed to happen? It's beyond me.
Right. It should not have.
I think we all know how Dr. Granberry voted.
Yeah.
He voted to release the client of his childhood friend, of course.
Yeah.
So on October 5th, 1989, they signed a parole certificate for Kenneth Allen McDuff, and he walked out a free man 6 days later.
Mm. Wow.
They ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Give them old Sparky, I say.
Yeah.
Now, news of Kenneth's release reached his hometown of Rosebud and the surrounding areas, and everyone was on high alert.
Well, yeah.
They're like, I'm sorry, what? What? Wasn't he sentenced to death?
Yeah.
People had their heads on a swivel, as you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And area schools were taking extra precautions with their safety measures.
Wow, good for them.
Yeah, like they were, you know, making sure more chaperones were available.
Wow.
It was terrifying. Can you imagine, like, being like, oh, he's gone. He's in there forever.
Right.
He's
we don't sentenced have to, worry. To death.
And then they release him. Ooh. Now, according to the book, Bad Boy from Rosebud, The Murderous Life of Kenneth Allen McDuff, which is by Carrie Laverne, this was my primary source, his own family couldn't even believe that he was released.
This is stupid. Like,
but nothing compares to the other shock and horror and outrage felt by the victims' families.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, jeez.
Now, his brother Lonnie, the only real friend he had, was murdered when Kenneth was still in prison. So he didn't have much to return to except for his life of crime and, you know, his mummy and his parole officer who was located in Tyler. Now, just 3 days after Kenneth was released, a body of a black woman was found in a field in Tyler.
Just 3 days?
Just 3 days.
I wonder who that could have been.
Hmm. She was brutally beaten and strangled.
Jesus help us.
And was later identified as 29-year-old sex worker Seraphia Moneta Parker. A witness told police that she saw Kenneth McDuff with Seraphia in his truck the night before, but with no physical evidence to go on, nothing came of this.
Because they don't care. They've proven it.
Exactly. There were other witnesses that said that Kenneth was utilizing the services of sex workers in the days after he was released from prison. His cousin even bought him one as a welcome back to society gift.
Ew.
Lena, your birthday's coming up.
No, please. I'm good. I'm good.
Not
going to
be buying you that for your birthday.
No. Okay? Thank you.
I didn't
you.
Know that cousins gifted sexual services, but yeah. That's
if you
not...
could refrain from that. Wow.
Lord, you've got to laugh to keep from crying about this stuff. Now, Kenneth was still running his mouth about killing people all around town. So he is still, to this day, suspected of being responsible for Seraphia's murder, but she never got justice.
So did he have any kind of probation rules that he had to, like...
So I don't know about the rules, but his parole officer was located in Tyler, which is why we believe this murder was him, because he... went to Tyler.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was kind of hanging around that area in the few days after his release. He did have to check in with his parole officer, and I'll get into the bouncing around. But it wouldn't take long for Kenneth to be in trouble with the law in an official capacity, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
In the summer of 1990, he hurled some racial slurs at a group of black teenagers in downtown Rosebud. They were doing absolutely nothing to provoke him, and certainly nothing is worthy of racial remarks anyways.
Right.
But Kenneth was just that kind of guy. I'm sure they responded in some form or fashion because Kenneth took off after one of them with a switchblade and threatened to kill him with the knife. Now, he was arrested for this incident. I mean, this is assault. Okay. Yeah. And he was put back right before the same parole board that saw fit to release him in the first place.
Okay.
The charge against him now was a misdemeanor for making terroristic threats. And even at his parole hearing, at the parole revocation hearing, he was still making loud racist comments like, well, they shouldn't be blah, 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 blah. And his attorney was like, shut up, please.
Yeah.
Shut your mouth.
You're not helping.
Shut your mouth. So Kenneth was sent back to prison. But this isn't even the end of the story. Couldn't be.
No.
because it seems like at every turn there is someone that gives this guy a pass for whatever reason. Now, Sheriff Pamplin, who was involved in taking Kenneth into custody back in 1966, was so frustrated with all of this mess. He had advised Falls County District Attorney Tom Sheehan that Kenneth would kill again.
Yeah.
He would kill again. He doesn't care if he ever got out of prison. But Tom Sheehan dropped the misdemeanor charge. There were some key witnesses that wouldn't testify. They were scared.
Oh, no.
That's not the whole reason why. I think he just dropped that charge because he felt like it wasn't enough. Should have gone for it anyway. That's what I'm saying. Just slap them with everything you can.
Exactly.
Just do your due diligence. Anyways, he dropped the charge. And almost in the same stroke of genius, Tom Sheehan penned a letter to the parole board saying, "This is the most extraordinarily violent criminal that's ever set foot into Falls County," and encouraged them not to reinstate his parole. Basically, "I'm going to drop this charge, but if y'all could maybe
not
reinstate his parole, that would be great."
No.
But Kenneth's attorney filed a motion to have his parole reinstated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I detailed for you earlier just how the parole boards worked when Kenneth was released. Well, at the time, Kenneth went back to prison and was eligible to get out again.
Mm-hmm.
They were so overburdened with their jobs, the parole boards, so they assembled these groups in their staff called hearing officers.
Okay.
This sounds like a five-year-old made up this story, doesn't it? Now, they would vote on an inmate's release on behalf of the parole board. These people were not qualified to make such a decision. It's ridiculous. Like, I can't even speak. I'm so angry. What's more, they didn't even do any sort of review had they been qualified in any capacity to do it. They just said, we don't see anything. We don't see any reason to keep him in prison.
He looks okay. We'll let him go.
So on December 6, 1990, Kenneth walked his sorry behind out of prison again. I got to go home now. I'm tired. I want to tell the rest of this. I'm exhausted.
Yeah, you're wearing me out.
Texas Monthly reported that after Kenneth was released in the late 1990s, or in late 1990, he moved around the state, sticking their family wherever they were, you know, here and there, working various jobs here and there. And here's what I mean about the parole thing. He was able to get his parole transferred multiple times, from Tyler to Waco to Belton to here.
Why?
Why would they let him? What I'm saying is...
Not that you're... Not just that they're letting him. Yes, that they're letting him. But do they not see or think to themselves, why is he moving around to all these places?
Is part of parole, the conditions of parole, I would think would be you need to be stable. You need to be establishing yourself back into society. Check in with us. Be consistent, get a job, you know, and this whole, they allowed this.
Yeah.
But here's why. It was said that there was a little over 1,000 parole officers in charge of 70,000 paroled inmates.
Wow.
So now we, you know, forget about overcrowding in prisons, we now have overcrowding in the streets.
Yeah.
With people on parole. In the streets.
Not being held accountable.
Right. So he landed in Waco eventually, changed his parole officer location to there, which is where one of his sisters lived. And he kind of bounced back and forth between sisters because they were just getting sick of his crap. He always had a new car, somehow, money, stuff. He was back to stealing, obviously, and robbing, you know, for money to get drugs. He even stole from his sisters and their families. He stole one of his nephew's trucks at one point. But whatever crimes he was committing were going unreported or under the radar because he stayed on the move and covered his tracks. And you have to remember, he was largely stealing from drug dealers and he was raping and assaulting sex workers. So they had their own reasons for not reporting these crimes. He was caught for things here and there, but he was slapped with fines, which he gladly paid. He's like, oh,
I'll just go steal from an old lady over here.
Now, Kenneth's parole officer at the time referred him to this program that helps inmates reintegrate into society. He's like, all right, guy, you got to get on a path here. So Kenneth actually enrolled in college in Waco and moved into the dorms.
Oh, how convenient.
Imagine. Now, this program was a 2-year technical school, which he actually ended up completing. But his goal wasn't to come out the other end with a degree or some newfound ambition.
No, I can tell you right now what his goal was.
Exactly. He was utilizing the free education and free housing in the dorms. Yeah. So he got a little job at the time. He was a cashier at a Quick Pack convenience store. He thought it'd be easy seed money for the drugs. Just ringing people up behind the register, you know, wouldn't have to do much.
Yeah.
But he soon learned that it's a little more than that, you know, stocking shelves, you know.
Oh, this, you mean I'm other, actually going to have to the work? Trash.
Exactly. And so he was like, eh, peace. He didn't last 3 weeks. Mm. So during the time he was in school, Kenneth was using drugs heavily. As I said, he was acquiring firearms, hanging out with drug dealers, pimps, sex workers, you know, the huge. Mm-hmm. In October of 91, two sex workers, first Brenda Thompson and days later Regina Moore, went missing. Kenneth was known to frequent a place called The Cut, which was the stretch of road that all the, you know, sex workers would stand and solicit and drug dealers, you know, were doing their thing. Plenty of people witnessed him abducting these women, but they didn't want to say anything. Now, there was one very important witness, a police officer.
Okay.
He tried to approach Kenneth's truck at a checkpoint, and he saw Brenda bound and gagged in the passenger seat, kicking and screaming.
Okay.
She even kicked out his window. And as the officer tried to, like, approach the car and intervene, or the truck, excuse me, Kenneth sped off and nearly ran the guy over.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he had to jump out of the way. Now, the guy got in his car and chased him down, but he lost him.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. They eventually caught up with him a couple days later. Authorities didn't have anything. They had the cop said, I saw you. And he's like, no, you didn't. What? There was no evidence.
Yeah. There's no body cam back in the 1990. Right.
And there's this little thing that they were sex workers.
Right.
And law enforcement felt they should be using their resources on other things like donuts, you know? And Kenneth moved on. Now, a couple months later, December 29th, 1991, Kenneth picked up a buddy named Hank Worley. And the plan was to head south to Austin to buy drugs. Now, Austin wasn't too far from Waco. And lucky for them, it was considered the speed capital of the world, according to him. So they'd be high as a kite soon enough. Mm. On the way, he stopped off at a gas station to fill up his tan Thunderbird, and he pumped and jumped.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, he left
without paying. Wouldn't expect anything more.
Rude. Then he stopped at another gas station on the way for beer. Are you getting flashbacks to his little Fort Worth road trip in part one?
With as soon as you said take a road trip to Austin, that's what I thought of.
Well, you really will when I tell you that on the way there, Kenneth talked about abducting a girl and using her up. And Hank just thought he was being silly.
Oh, no. Not this again.
A convicted murderer. He's just being silly.
Yeah.
He knew what Kenneth had done in the past.
Unbelievable.
He knew. So this very same night, a beautiful 28-year-old woman named Colleen Reed was out running errands. She was a certified public accountant with the Lower Colorado River Authority in Austin, but was actually originally from Louisiana. And she served in the Marine Corps Reserves.
Oh.
She had recently broken off an engagement with her fiancé, Oliver, but they still really cared for each other, and they were dating, kind of trying to see where things went and okay. figure things out. That night, she drove her Mazda Miata to an ATM to deposit $200 that her dad gave her for Christmas. Mm. Remember, this is just days after Christmas. And with only $128.33 in her bank account, she really needed to get that money in there. Now, the bank CCTV snapped some pictures of her in her gold rim glasses and her white windbreaker.
Aww.
She is adorable, completing her transaction and then leaving the ATM. Next, Colleen went to Whole Foods on North Lancaster Street, where she bought milk and some vitamins. Sounds like a healthy girl.
Yeah, gotta have those vitamins.
Yeah, and she paid cash and she left just before 9 p.m. A few streets over, she was like, I'm gonna stop off and get my car washed, or just wash my car. It was a self-serve car wash. So she parked in one of the stalls and got out and began cleaning her car. Now, in a series of unfortunate events, about that time, Kenneth and Hank drove by. And Kenneth spotted Colleen all by herself in the dark in that lonely car wash stall.
I don't like that.
Yeah. Kenneth pulled into the furthest car wash stall. Colleen was just two stalls down. He exited his car, and still Hank was like, what's he doing?
Where are you going?
Are you kidding me, Hank? Please, Hank. So after Kenneth gets out of the car, Hank's like, well, I guess I'll clean up these beer bottles. So he's grabbing the beer bottles from the front seat, the back seat, throwing them in the little, you know, receptacle right there. And then here comes McDuff, dragging Colleen over, kicking and screaming.
Wow.
Trying to shove her in the car. Now, Kenneth gets kicked around pretty good by Colleen.
You go, okay? Girl.
He was messing with the wrong woman. She put up one heck of a fight till the end.
Oh.
So when he tried forcing her in the car, she wasn't going in that car.
No, ma'am.
She was getting rigid, and she was like, you're going to have to break me in half to get me in this car. So what did he do? Hank, hold her down.
And he did.
And he helped. He assisted in getting her into the back seat. Now, a street away, two men were standing on their porch, on the porch of their sister's house, talking. They were getting ready to go to dinner, and they hear this blood-curdling scream coming from the car wash, which was just, they could see it. They could see it just right down the road.
Oh, my goodness.
And they look over, and they were gobsmacked because here comes this tan Thunderbird peeling out of the car wash. You see, just minutes before, maybe 5 to 10 minutes uh-huh. before this happened, they encountered the same car at an intersection on 6th Street.
Oh.
Kenneth was going the wrong way down the street, and these two men in their car were trying to go to his sister's house, and they were like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So they got a really good look at him.
Oh.
Because they had to like go around him.
Interesting.
And now here the same car, just after a loud woman scream, mm-hmm. is peeling out from the car wash.
Wow.
They were like, what are the odds? So the men got in their car and sped over to the car wash to make sure everybody, like someone was okay or whatever. So maybe someone got hit by the car. And all they found was a soapy Mazda Miata with someone's purse and keys still inside, along with what appeared to be a grocery bag. The men had chills going down their spines.
Yeah.
They just heard an abduction.
Yeah.
So they raced back to his sister's house and they called 911. Back in the Thunderbird, we have Hank's account of events.
Okay.
This is really tough, guys. This is hard. I'm leaving out some details, but here it goes. Kenneth drove near the capital of Texas highway and stopped the car, ordering Hank to crawl in up into the front seat. He was not about to let him out of the car. Kenneth got out and said, you crawl up here and drive. I'm getting in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
And Hank did as he was told. And he just basically drove around while Kenneth mercilessly raped Colleen, belittling her, making fun of her, and joking the whole time.
Oh, no.
Now, Hank got on Highway 183 to head to his sister's house. I don't know what was going through his mind. Like, I got to get somewhere I know where I'm at. I don't know. But he pulls off onto Ranch Road 620, which was a desolate area with houses just kind of dotted here and there. But they were approaching the business end of the street. So it was desolate until they started getting to this like industrial area.
Mm-hmm.
Colleen went nuts. She could see that they were kind of getting into a more populated area. She started screaming, kicking, and trying to get somebody's attention. Maybe somebody would see her. She ended up scratching Kenneth. Maybe he would let her out. And he punched her so hard. And she was like, okay, okay, okay. And she just stopped fighting back.
Oh my gosh.
Now he bummed one of Hank's cigarettes and began burning her.
Oh Lord.
With it to keep her in line. Like, try that again and see what happens. By now, Hank had driven about 6 miles from the car wash where they had abducted Colleen. And Kenneth said, pull over and let me drive. Just like the abduction and murder of Louise Sullivan, Kenneth's little sidekick climbed in the back seat and took his turn raping Colleen.
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh.
Kenneth took Highway 35 towards his parents' house just north of Belton. Kenneth knew the area pretty well, and he knew an isolated place he could stop. Just off Cedar Creek and 317, Kenneth parked the car in an overgrown area, exited the car, and pulled poor Colleen out by her beautiful brown hair. She had her hands tied behind her back at this point. She was completely naked, pleading with him to just leave her there. But he raped her again at that location. She fought again because something in her snapped and she said, you know what? This has gone too far and I'm not taking it anymore.
Yeah, she decided that I'm at least going to make it hard for you.
Yeah, exactly. So she bit him.
Okay.
Yeah, she bit him. And he reared back and with all his might, he hit her in the head. And Hank said it sounded like a tree branch snapping. Colleen fell to the ground and never moved again. She was dead. Kenneth loaded Colleen's body into the trunk and drove to drop off Hank at his house. And all the way there, he was given the same pep talk that he gave to Roy Dell Green all those years ago. You better not say anything.
Yeah.
Or I'll kill you.
Mm-hmm. And he believed it. And he was scared.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Now, Kenneth asked Hank for a shovel. And Hank was like, I don't have one. Sorry about that. So he's like, oh, okay. So he dropped Hank off, and with Colleen still in the trunk, he drove away. Back in Austin, the investigation into Colleen's disappearance began with that 911 phone call placed by the two men mm-hmm. who heard that loud scream. A patrolman, Robert Bohannon, responded to the car wash about 9:25, so just not that long after it happened, where he was met by the witnesses, Stephen Marks and Bill Goines. When Officer Bohannon looked into Colleen's car, he saw exactly what the two men had seen. Nothing was taken. Her purse, her identification was there, so they knew who it was right away.
Mm-hmm.
Her keys, her groceries, some books were even in there. All right there inside, just as she must have left it.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen and Bill gave their statements, including a description of the car that they saw speeding away. They thought it was maybe a 87 to 89 Thunderbird or Cougar. They weren't really sure which. I would be like, I don't know. It's tan.
Yeah.
I would never be able to identify a car. Now, since Colleen's car was registered to her ex-fiance Oliver's address, police called him to see if maybe she was with him or he picked her up or something. And they told him how they found her car and he was frantic.
Oh.
He called Colleen over and over and over again, just thinking this is a mistake. Like,
yeah, she's got to be okay.
Someone stole her car and they left it that way, you know? Now, finally, he was able to reach Colleen's sister the next morning, who she was very close to. And obviously that stomach drop moment
mm-hmm.
happens, you know, that nobody wants to experience. Police had little to go on other than the ATM and Whole Foods receipts, which would help them track her movements leading up to the moments that she was abducted. But sadly, we know, would not help them find her. Now, just as soon as the investigation started, it stalled. They had not one shred of physical evidence at the scene. No prints, no hair, no nothing. They only had the description of the vehicle speeding away from the scene and the description of the men inside the car. Mm. Well, something else that influenced the zealousness with which the police investigated the case was Austin Police Department's attitude towards Colleen herself.
Okay.
With absolutely no evidence to suggest this is true at all, police implied, Lori, maybe your sister just did some drugs and ran away.
No. Thank you, but no.
Because you know that it is probably the woman's fault.
Maybe you're doing drugs and you need to do a better job.
Yeah, you're on drugs. I mean, it is easier actually to just say they ran away than actually look for a missing person.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
So at least they're trying to be efficient. Sarcasm. So Lori and Oliver found themselves doing what a lot of families do when their loved ones are missing or murdered. They began an investigation of their own. Mm-hmm. They went to her apartment to see if they could find any clues. But other than a big old mess that her cat made with some paper napkins, the apartment was fairly tidy. Her door was unlocked, which at that time is not uncommon. And it wasn't uncommon for her. She obviously was coming right back. She ran out to run errands and she did that all the time. You know, she wouldn't have been gone for more than 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. There was nothing there. Now, the day after Colleen's murder, Hank's sister, Hank the accomplice, mm-hmm. heard him squealing like a little pig from his room early in the morning.
Okay.
He was having bad dreams.
Oh, I'm sure he was.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what happens when you participate in
evil
stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was the first inclination that he gave that something wasn't okay. Then the following day, they had a New Year's Eve party at his family's house. And he just kind of started unraveling before everyone's eyes.
Oh.
He'd arrived drunk. He couldn't be still for 2 seconds. He was pacing all around the place. And he'd asked his sister and brother-in-law what they would do if they saw a woman getting beat up and he couldn't intervene. They were like, What do you mean you couldn't help? Like, why couldn't you help her?
Yeah.
And they probably thought he was at first talking in hypotheticals, but then he was like, he would have killed me. So now they're like, I think he's gotten himself into trouble. So about this time, the conversation got cut off because more partygoers started arriving.
Okay.
And they didn't speak of it again. By the time February rolled around, Kenneth was arrested for public intoxication, but his sentence for that was suspended and he was put on probation.
You're making me so mad.
Now, I didn't know you could be on parole and probation at the same time. But that's Kenneth Allen McDuff. Days after he hit the streets again, another sex worker who was last seen with Kenneth McDuff had gone missing. Her name was Valencia K. Joshua. And she was a young black woman with an extensive criminal history. She had dropped out of high school. She was estranged from her family. She was just the perfect target for this scumbag. Now, remember that little cashier job that Kenneth had at the Quick Pack?
Right.
Well, when Kenneth was in training to be a cashier there, he worked at a couple different locations to like learn the ropes. And he was introduced to this girl named Melissa Ann Northrup at Quick Pack store number 8. Melissa was born December 8th, 1969 in Galveston, Texas. Mm. She had grown into a beautiful, vibrant, married, young mother, two children, and she was pregnant with her third child.
Oh.
She was very petite. She weighed about 100 pounds.
Goodness.
She was 5 foot. And she had expressed her concerns about working at the Quick Pack to her mother, telling her the security cameras didn't work. Mm. There's this little bell that sounds like when someone walks in the door, but if she's in the back room, like stalking things, she can't hear it.
Oh.
And management told her to get a hearing aid if she can't
hear it.
Yeah.
And her being so teeny. Mm-hmm. She needs another person there with her. Come on.
Yeah. But she didn't have a high school diploma. And jobs were slim pickings.
Right.
So she did what she had to do to support her growing family. She didn't like it. But
she did if what it she missed, had to do.
If it meant, you know, having to risk her safety for that $4.50 an hour, she was going to do it.
Aww.
Now, someone else noticed how isolated that location was. When Kenneth McDuff first visited store number 8 during his employment there, he noticed how even though the gas station is right off of a major highway, at night, you can't see it.
Mm. Convenient.
From the road. Mm-hmm. And he thought about it. And the more he thought about it, the more he wanted to rob the place. Mm-hmm. He even talked openly to other fellow students about how easy it would be to rob that location and get away with it.
Wow.
Yes, please talk about how easy.
Well, because
I'm going to get away with it, but here I am talking about it.
Well, because he is going to get away with it.
Yeah. So February 29th, 1992, Melissa went to work her store clerk job at Quick Pack Store on the corner of New Road and Highway 35. Mm. It was the graveyard shift, which was her shift, and she usually worked from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and she was working alone. Her husband, Aaron, would come check on her or call her periodically because he also didn't like her working there by herself.
Aww.
He knew she was vulnerable, and this night was no different. Aaron had stopped by to see Melissa about 1 a.m. and stayed for about 30 minutes. And when he got home, he called to say, "Hey, I'm home, just checking on you." So she called Aaron again about 2 a.m. and was like, "Hi, have I said how much I hate working here in the last 30 minutes?" Then the conversation kind of switched gears to talking about the baby and their future that they had ahead of them. He called her again a little later around 3:45, but she was busy and she asked him to hold on. And he was like, "Never mind, I need to go to sleep." So he just hung up the phone. Now, about 15 minutes later, she called him back and his sister woke him up and said, "Melissa's on the phone." And he said, "I really need to get my sleep. So just tell her I'll call her back." Now, I'm sure Aaron tried to shut his eyes, but he probably felt like a major douche.
Oh.
So he got up and called to apologize, but she didn't pick up.
Uh-oh.
And she didn't answer any of the subsequent calls that he placed after that either. And he knew something wasn't right.
Yeah.
Finally, around 4:45 a.m., he grabbed his keys and he got in his car to go check on her. When he arrived, he didn't see Melissa's car. And there were practically tumbleweeds blowing around the store, except for one lone customer standing at the register, kind of looking around, waiting to be rung up. And Aaron was like, "Is there no one here?" And the guy was like, "No, I guess not."
Oh my gosh.
So Aaron went behind the counter, hit the sale button. The cash register was completely empty.
Oh no.
Can you imagine? Then he looks down and there's Melissa's purse behind the register. And if he didn't throw up right then.
Yeah.
He was wasting no time. He called police immediately. Now, we'll never know truly how the events played out that night. But what we do know is that the night Melissa disappeared, Kenneth McDuff left his mother's house in a rage. He had recently completed his college courses and he didn't get a job that he applied for. There was a letter waiting for
him. Wow, wow.
I know, exactly. So he's like, "Oh, I wanted that job." Earlier in the night, he had gone on this bender with some friends, drugs, drinking, crack, you know, people stealing his cigarettes, and he was fired up. And news of not getting that job. And the time is up. That's all the time we have for today. So after he saw the letter about not getting that job, that was it. That was the last straw for him. Oh, no. That wasn't the last straw for him because his car broke down.
Oh.
He was near the Quick Pack. His car broke down. So he pushed his car to the Quick Pack and he's like, "Something's going to happen now." Uh-huh. Like, I'm bound and determined something bad's going to happen.
So was he still driving the tan Thunderbird?
Yes.
Okay.
He was still driving that tan Thunderbird. After getting some passerby to help him push his car to the gas station, he left in Melissa's car.
Oh, okay.
With Melissa inside. and he was seen by a fellow student. Jerry Myers knew Kenneth, and he actually knew Melissa as well. And so he saw Kenneth drive by. It wasn't at the Quick Pack, but it was like
right
a ways away. And Melissa had this horrified look on her face.
No.
And it really freaked the guy out. He was like, that didn't look right.
Yeah, something's wrong.
And he didn't know them to be friends.
Okay.
And he knew all about Kenneth McDuff. So Kenneth drove her up to a remote area in Dallas County, where he pulled off onto James Road and ended up getting Melissa's car stuck in the mud. This is really not his night.
Yeah.
So just call it a night and go home.
Yeah.
Okay.
Give it a rest.
He had no choice but to abandon the car. So he made Melissa walk through fields, traversing through tall grass and barbed wire fences until finally reaching a flooded gravel pit. It was there that he raped and murdered her and left her floating in the water. In the days after her abduction, friends and family, law enforcement fanned out looking everywhere for Melissa. Simultaneously, Addie McDuff was looking for her boy because Kenneth had fled.
Yeah.
She called police to report Kenneth missing.
Nobody
Not
cares.
Not sure what she was thinking there. Because by filing a missing persons report on her son, who was on parole and probation, the police knew that Kenneth was no longer in the area, thus violating the terms of his parole.
It just gets better and better.
Now,
or worse and worse,
yeah,
I should
it's
say.
Worse and worse. It didn't take much to tie Kenneth McDuff to Melissa's abduction. His car was there. He was spotted by a woman driving early the morning of March 1st. And then in a bold move, Kenneth knocked on a door of a house near the gravel pits and asked for some food.
I'm hungry. Can I have some crackers, please?
I am serious. He asked for a sandwich. And she's like, I got some beans.
Give me some sugar water. What's that mean?
Men in Black. Yeah. I know Edgar, and I wasn't Edgar. It's exactly like that because he looks inside and this lady's husband is sitting there with a shotgun propped up to his recliner. He's like, you can eat your beans and leave, sir.
Oh.
So Kenneth didn't try to pull anything lest he be shot in the face.
Okay.
And blown apart. So he ate his beans and left, but he put himself there. An emergency arrest warrant was issued for Kenneth McDuff for violating his parole. March 10th, 1992, Austin police got a call from McLennan County Sheriff's Department notifying them that Kenneth McDuff's car was found at the scene of an abduction, and it fit the description of the Thunderbird seen leaving the car wash in Colleen Reed's abduction.
Mm.
And he was like, I think this is your guy. I think this is both of our guy.
Yeah.
We don't know how Kenneth McDuff managed to get away from the gravel pits that night. He was on foot. We can speculate that he had help getting out of the area. But he made his way to Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh.
Go Taylor's boyfriend. He stayed at a homeless shelter for a while under the name of Richard Fowler. He started working as a garbage man. Fitting, if you ask me. Then he got himself an apartment. What? Seems like he was just going to set up shop there and just live in Kansas City.
Okay.
And maybe he would have flown under the radar if it wasn't for one thing.
Okay. Do tell.
Who he was. He couldn't keep his hands out of the cookie jar.
Oh.
He was arrested for trying to hire a prostitute, although it wasn't a prostitute at all. It was an undercover policewoman.
Okay. Oh, gosh.
But they let him go.
Oh.
Because they didn't know they had a serial killer. They thought it was just some lowly guy named Richard Fowler.
Oh, no.
No big deal there. Be on your way, sir. Now, back in Texas, though, there was a simultaneous hunt for Kenneth McDuff and his victims. They're looking for Colleen Reed. They're looking for Melissa. They're looking for these sex workers that are missing. Now, Colleen Reed's case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and the search for her was expanding in full swing. Officers spoke with the McDuff family, even performed a search at J.A. and Addie McDuff's home. They visited the cut and spoke with people that Kenneth used to run around with. And they were starting to put these little pieces together mm-hmm. to connect Kenneth McDuff to the missing sex workers and the disappearances of Colleen Reed and Melissa Northrup. A major break came, though, in March, March 25th to be exact, when police in Waco got a call that a man was taking his lunch break in the woods, but he stumbled on what he believed to be a head sticking out of the ground. When investigators from the McLennan County Sheriff's Department arrived on scene, they found what appeared to be a crude, shallow grave containing the body of a young woman. The body was entirely buried except for the skull that was a little bit exposed. Now, after fingerprints were taken, they knew they had found Valencia K. Joshua, the missing sex worker that disappeared just the month before. Mm. Not only did they have her body, which in and of itself is crucial evidence, they found foreign hairs that didn't belong to her.
Okay.
And they would later be identified as belonging to Kenneth McDuff. The various interviews that they conducted with Kenneth's old acquaintances eventually led police right to Hank Worley.
Oh.
We've been waiting for this.
Right.
The only other person that could help us in Colleen Reed's investigation. At first, he wasn't willing to tell police the truth because he was scared of Kenneth. But on April 20th, after strong encouragement from his family, they're like, you got to set this right.
Yeah.
Hank gave a statement to the Bell County Sheriff's Department. He took them to the site of Colleen's murder, which was very near the McDuff family home.
No.
But a search of the area didn't yield any clues as to where Colleen was. Remember, Kenneth took her body with him.
Oh, right.
Hank didn't know where she was now.
Right.
Something else of value that came from Hank's statement to the police was talk of that good-looking cashier that McDuff wanted to snatch at the Quick Pack. You know, Melissa Northrup,
mm-hmm.
the one who actually went missing. They already knew that Kenneth's car was at the scene. And sightings of him that morning, one lady saw him walking down the street, the lady with the beans. So they knew they were on the right track. A media storm by this point was swirling with Kenneth's ugly mug plastered all over TV in the nightly news, even an episode of America's Most Wanted. Then there were the newspapers and word of mouth, you name it.
Yeah.
Also, Hank Worley's name was out there, too, as having been an accomplice to Colleen Reed's murder.
Well,
Colleen's family hadn't been told that she was murdered. So they learned of this on the news, that she was presumed dead.
That is so...
They were furious. I can't even imagine finding that out on the news. April 26th, they were still searching for Colleen in Austin when a fisherman in Waco found a woman's body floating in a water-filled gravel pit. It was Melissa Ann Northrup.
No.
She was found floating face up with her arms tied behind her back with her shoelaces.
No.
And her shirt was pulled up over her face.
What?
Now, the pool of water wasn't that deep. It was about 4 feet deep. So Dallas County Sheriff's Deputy Timothy Parker believed she might have been weighed down at some point. Mm. Otherwise, maybe she would have been found sooner. She had been placed there since the day she was abducted. So she was badly decomposed from the water and animal activity. Yes, there were fish and stuff in that gravel pit. I know it sounds weird. Hence the fisherman finding her.
Okay.
So the medical examiner positively identified her, but could not determine a cause of death.
Hmm.
He did, however, say that the manner of death was homicidal violence. I mean, duh.
Yeah.
Melissa's family was crushed. I mean, they kind of knew. They kind of felt like she wasn't coming home. But now they knew she was never coming home.
Right.
They'd never see her again. They'd never meet the baby that was growing inside her. And that her death was so violent.
Mm.
But unlike Colleen's family, they were able to have her body back and bury her and start to heal and move on and as best you can.
Right.
And at least they had some answers. Finally, in early May of 1992, Kansas City police got a call from a worker at Longview Disposal Systems and said, "Hey, I work with this guy named Richard Fowler. And I'm telling you, he's the guy I saw last night on America's Most Wanted."
Interesting.
I swear he's that Kenneth McDuff guy.
Yeah.
Luckily, Kansas City PD had this Richard Fowler guy's fingerprints on file, you know, from his recent arrest.
Uh-huh.
And they compared those fingerprints with the known fingerprints of Kenneth Allen McDuff, and they were a match. They'd found him. But they needed to make sure they didn't lose him mm-hmm. again. They knew they had one shot, so they conducted this sting to arrest him while he was working, where they knew they could find him and nail him down. On May 4th, 7 officers set up a weigh and inspection station, which Kenneth stopped at in his garbage truck.
He was actually following the rules?
I guess so. I guess he took pride in his work.
Okay.
He rolled up in his garbage truck and they took him down. They threw him to the ground and cuffed him and took him to the Blue Springs Correctional Facility. When news reached the officers in Texas, they were elated. I mean, they're probably slapping each other's butts and high fives and chest bumps, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were all itching to get to Kansas to bring him home themselves. Okay. They were like,
so now you care.
I want to go. Now I want to go. Yeah, exactly. Bobby Hoagland, a U.S. Marshal, Joe Wiley, a Texas Ranger, and Jeff Brzozowski, I'm so sorry, with the ATF assembled a team and took a U.S. Marshal Service plane to Kansas.
Hmm.
When they rolled up in their boots and their hats, the Kansas City PD was like, whoa, did all of you need to come?
Yes.
And they're like, yes, we all needed to come. Okay. We all needed to come. So they brought Kenneth into an interrogation room in Kansas City, and he calmly asked why he was there. He's like, what's up, fellas? What are we all doing here?
Oh.
Yeah.
You don't know?
Acted like he had done nothing wrong, which I bet enraged the detectives.
Oh, man.
He said, I'll answer your questions. You can search my apartment. I have nothing to hide. Now, there was a lot of talking in circles during this interview. Kenneth admitted to hanging out with some convicts, even joking about being mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries, though he called it Mysterious Mysteries. He didn't want to talk about anything of substance, really, as you can imagine, like how he made it to Kansas City, and he denied any involvement with any of the victims. I bet every one of those officers from Texas wanted to rip his limbs
off of his
grubby body, but they wanted justice for the families, so they brought him home to Texas. Now a new kind of storm was starting to brew in the state of Texas. They had their man, but now information was coming out to the public about how Kenneth got released in the first place.
Okay.
Okay. And how the parole boards weren't doing their jobs, letting dangerous criminals back out into the general population, and people were dumbfounded.
Yeah.
Could this happen again? Would this happen again?
Probably.
And are there other serial killers walking among us, working alongside us, renting apartments next to us, passing our children on the street? So you have this undertow of political mess leading up to his trial for the murder of Melissa Northrup in 1993. He pled not guilty, as you can imagine, and he called the charges trumped up. He got slapped with a federal charge, actually, as well, in addition to the sexual assault and murder charges due to the possession of firearms. Witnesses testified about Kenneth's binge drinking and drug use the night Melissa was taken. And Addie McDuff herself testified that he was in quite a bad mood that night because of the job rejection.
Wow.
The judge actually allowed evidence and testimony from Colleen Reed's case in this trial, which included the testimony of Hank Worley.
Okay.
And just like Alec Murdoch, Kenneth McDuff took the stand in his own defense. Like Alec Murdoch, it was an epic fail. Yeah. He tried being his own defense attorney at one point. He was just this arrogant.
Get over yourself.
He's just terrible. Now, the jury was disgusted.
Mm-hmm.
They found him guilty of Melissa Northrup's murder, and they sentenced him to death, which by now was back on the table in Texas.
Okay.
Now, the murder trial for Colleen Reed kicked off in early 1994. The star witness was none other than Hank Worley, who was there, who detailed for the court the night of Colleen's abduction and murder. The defense tried to paint Hank as a liar, which it is true. He lied about a lot of stuff, but Hank detailed the events of that night.
Mm-hmm.
He told the truth about his participation in raping her, which...
Why would he
say that if it wasn't true?
Right.
Even some murderers won't even admit when they sexually assault a victim. And the testimony from Hank lined up with the evidence they had. So her being abducted from the car wash so abruptly that all her things were left behind the way it happened, that no evidence was left behind. Kenneth was convinced not to take the stand this time, but it wouldn't matter either way. Okay? It wouldn't have mattered.
No.
The jury came back after 2.5 hours with a verdict of guilty on all counts, capital murder, aggravated sexual assault, and aggravated kidnapping, and the judge handed down another death sentence. I said it before, Kenneth McDuff's crimes gave way to major changes in the Texas criminal justice system. Billions of dollars funded the construction of more prisons. A set of laws were created called the McDuff Laws, which changed parole laws in a major way. This made it so that an inmate had to serve at least 40 years of a life sentence before being considered for parole.
Interesting.
And the parole board would now be made up of 18 people, not three.
Wow.
Another change was that they did away with this whole parole reinstatement
nonsense.
Meaning, if you're arrested while you're on parole, that's it.
Yeah,
you're donezo.
You don't get another chance.
There is no parole reinstatement. It's revoked. You don't get a third, fourth, fifth chance.
Stupid.
Bye. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Those changes desperately needed to be made.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at what cost?
Yeah. The lives of how
Brenda,
many people?
Regina, Valencia, Melissa, Colleen.
Right.
These are just the victims we know about.
Exactly.
Police firmly believe that he's connected to many more. Now, in September of 1998, for whatever reason, Kenneth told police where they could find Regina and Brenda's bodies, and they were successfully recovered. He was vague at first about where Colleen was. He was trying to keep something to himself so that he would get stays for his execution date.
Okay.
And he did. He would give them a little. They would go look. They couldn't find her. And he ended up getting a stay, and they pushed his execution date back. Oh, and all the while, he's still maintaining he didn't kill her.
Mm-hmm.
That Hank killed her.
Right.
And he was just
okay.
there.
Okay. Okay.
But eventually he specified where Colleen was located near the Brazos River, and she was recovered and brought back to her family in October of 1998. Kenneth McDuff, this is the last name time I'll say his nasty name, was executed via lethal injection, too good if you ask me, November 17th, 1998.
Hmm.
At Walls Prison in Huntsville, Texas. And he is currently disintegrating in the fiery pits of hell, if you need him further.
I would think so.
Whew.
Are you done? I just keep waiting for you to say, but wait, there's more.
Yeah, he came back to life.
No.
And no, he's dead. He's dead. He can never kill anyone else. This is like the worst person we've ever covered. I feel like
stomach turning. Like I that was hard to listen to, let alone dig in and find all, you know, research. So,
and you know, it's unfortunate that some of his victims were marginalized and we don't have a lot of information about their background and their family, and, you know, they're considered in a different sector than Melissa and Colleen, who had, you know, but not really. I mean, they're all just women, you know, you can't judge.
No,
you cannot judge.
I know,
you
but
don't
I mean,
know where they come from.
There's somebody's sister, exactly. daughter. Yeah. I mean, we've heard lots of cases where they've talked about, you know, sex workers who they don't feel are as important as others, mm-hmm. but they, I mean, wow. I just, these people who don't care enough to review his record to, and they're just like, okay, I can't wrap my mind around, like, you're playing with people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I have no other words for that. It just boggles my mind.
I know. Let's never speak of him again.
No.
Good riddance, you loony, is what I say. Rest yeah. in peace.
All you angels.
To all his victims, the ones we don't even know about. Serafia, she was never officially classified as one of his victims.
Oh, okay.
She was found murdered, of course, a few days after he was released. We feel like that was his mm-hmm. responsibility. You know, he was responsible for that. But there's just so many more. The Austin Yogurt Shop murders, which I have on my list to cover.
Oh.
He was suspected in those murders. And still is suspected, but they don't have any evidence to.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I have to go now.
Okay, we're done. That was a lot.
It was painful. So,
yeah, we'll let y'all go.
Yeah, guys, give yourselves a hug. I want to reach through and hug you. We need to hold each other
and
right now.
Be aware of your surroundings, okay? Just, you know, your sister is always like, so what if I want to be by myself? What's, you know, I want to go on a road trip by mm-hmm. myself. And
I know. I'm like, no.
I've done it several times. I used to love going on road trips by myself. And I still do sometimes. But, I mean, there's...
I know.
Sneaky snakes.
I know.
Lurking in the darkness. And
that's why I try to maintain this profile right. that you see before you. Unshowered, no makeup, greasy hair. I don't want to be kidnapped.
Okay.
So I try to remain unkidnappable
okay.
at all times.
Wow.
So I'm just saying, tip.
Yeah. Take it as you will.
Anyway, great.
This was great.
Yeah, this is so great.
Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah. See you guys. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to our show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or send case suggestions to cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.